From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
True enough. I mean, and of all those characters, you know, obviously Red Fox, tremendously important, especially in Los Angeles and the comedy world that developed here. Dick Gregory, we all know how important he was politically and every other way. Bill, on the other hand, though, was not only, you know, on the scene, but he was in the mainstream. And Richard, in fact, when he first began, you know, was on the road to sort of owning his own voice and telling his own stories. But at a certain point, I think he told the story about being on tour in Toronto and seeing a picture of Bill Cosby in Time magazine and thinking, you know, this guy's doing what I'm trying to do. And, you know, according to Richard, you know, they're only going to let one of us through the door at a time. If I have any hope of getting anything real significant going, I'm going to have to do what he's doing. And for a while, he modeled himself after Bill's very congenial, non-threatening nightclub act that had been so successful. But I think, you know, in a very short period of time, he realized that was not his authentic voice, and he certainly couldn't tell his authentic stories and be that pleasant only.
Joe Henry, co-author of Furious Cool, Richard Pryor and the World That Made Him, published by Workman Publishing. No one who saw Richard Pryor along on stage with nothing but a microphone in his hand could have doubted that here was a man possessed of genius. But few have any sense of the strange, violent, and colorful landscape from which he emerged. His childhood in Peoria, Illinois was spent just surviving, yet the culture into which he was born, his mother was a prostitute and his grandmother ran a brothel, helped shape him into one of the most influential and outstanding performers of our time. Pryor attracted admiration and anger in equal parts. He was a comedian who many considered the greatest ever, yet his triumphant stand-up work has been largely eclipsed by his mediocre movie output. His personal life was likewise something of a contradiction, because Pryor was a man of deep intelligence and sensitivity, yet was also one who could never seem to make the pieces of his life come together to create a whole. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Furious Cool, Richard Pryor and the World That Made Him, with co-author Joe Henry, In Black America.
But also a really, really important point that we make, you know, right up front in the book is that if you were to just read the text of some of his greatest routines, there's nothing funny about them. In fact, many of them are wickedly sad and brutal.
Right.
It was, you know, his delivery that allowed us to see them, you know, in a humorous light, but absolutely to the point of his very unique gift that you know, he used comedy as a delivery system, but what he was really getting at, for the most part, was absolutely not funny. It was the most dire aspects of our existence, you know, which is why we needed him so badly, somebody who could, you know, share some insights into that part of our, you know, our humanity and our brokenness and our failure to connect with each other, you know, in a way that, you know, we can bear to accept. And when you get people laughing through things like that, you know, their guard is down and they take it in, as opposed to being defensive about it. And again, you read through them and you think on paper, you know, what's funny about this? But then you hear him deliver it and you can imagine it almost no other way.
Richard Pryor was, according to some, the single most influential performer of the second half of the 20th century, and certainly he was one of the most successful African-American actor-comedians ever. Controversial and somewhat mysterious during his life, Pryor's performances opened up a whole new world of possibilities, merging fantasy and angry reality in a way that wasn't just new, it was heretofore unthinkable. Now with this groundbreaking and revealing work, Joe and David Henry bring him alive again both as a man and as an artist, providing an in-depth appreciation of his talent and his lasting influence, as well as an insightful examination of the world he lived in and the myriad influences that shaped both his persona and his art. David Henry is a screenwriter and his brother Joe is a songwriter-singer as well as a music producer. They first discovered Richard Pryor when they were young, becoming instant fans, and then later, they were able to meet the man and spend time with him. They set out initially to write a screenplay for a projected film. Fortunately, they also wrote a biography. Furious Cool is their first book. In Black America recently spoke with Joe Henry.
I was born in Charlotte, North Carolina, but my father worked for the automobile industry, and even though it's not true any longer, back in his day, if you were a lifer in that racket, you know, all roads led to Detroit, so we wound up in the Michigan area by the time I was in high school. And I am, by occupation, I'm a singer and a songwriter and a record producer. I've never written a book before this one, so to extend, you know, my writing mind to something of this length has been a new bit of discovery for me.
When did you realize you had that talent to write and produce music?
Well, you know, I've always cared about song, the power of song, and the way that it connects all of us in the community of song. I think I instinctively believed that before anybody would have even asked me what mattered to me or what I thought I was going to do with my life. I just believed when I looked at certain singers and songwriters as I was growing up, I just recognized them as being of my tribe. And I just walked in that direction. I never considered doing anything else.
And any friendly competition between you and your brother, David?
Not in the least. I mean, from the time that
friendly
I was...
Friendly or competition?
I'm saying there's no competition between us that I know of. My brother David has been my closest ally and my mentor my whole life. I don't recall beyond, you know, 8 years old, you know, a crossword between us, to be completely honest with you.
I understand that you wrote a Grammy Award winning album with Solomon Burke.
Well, I produced his record that won us both the Grammy. I did indeed. His so-called comeback record of 2002 called Don't Give Up On Me.
I understand on the way to writing a screenplay, you all end up writing the book Furious Cool, Richard Pryor and the World That Made Him.
Well, the beginning of the story is that I wrote a song where I sang in first person as Richard. It's called Richard Pryor Addresses a Tearful Nation. And I recorded it on my own album of 2000 called Scar. And I recorded it with the great Ornette Coleman, the pivotal alto saxophonist. And long story short, the fact that I had used Richard's name in a song title led me to meet him. And then I wrote an article for Esquire magazine about Richard and about Ornette and how the idea of writing about one led me to work with the other. And based on that, Richard and his wife asked me if I would write a screenplay based on Richard's life. And I said, well, I'm no screenwriter. And they said, we know. Richard doesn't want a screenwriter. He likes that you're a songwriter. And I said, well, if I was going to take this on, even as an experiment, I would need some help. And I enlisted my brother David's help. And that put us on this journey, which ultimately, we decided a book gave us more freedom as writers than a screenplay, even though we finished a screenplay. Who knows what will ever happen with one. But the book, we felt like we could say whatever we wanted, and we didn't need really anybody's permission to do it.
What was it about Richard that fascinated you and your brother David?
Well, in a nutshell, John, I would say that at the point when Richard really came on our radar, I was 11. We were living in Ohio at the time, sort of near Cleveland. And Richard, to us, both David and I, he was in the same category as Bob Dylan and Miles Davis. He was a seminal artist who connected our humanity, you know, made us, you know, we saw ourselves in him and recognized him in us. And, you know, we've been asked many times, you know, we're Caucasians from the South, and people have asked in polite ways and in not polite ways where we got the nerve to try to write about Richard. And I always say, I didn't ever think about myself as being a white person approaching a black artist. I found him a human being that touched me and told me something about, you know, the many more things that connect us that then separate us. And that's just sort of how we come at it. You know, we're not trying to look at him as anything other than a struggling, wondrous human being who offered so many of us an image of ourselves that we could accept somehow, if that makes sense to you.
Yes, it does. We all have images of individuals we want to meet, but once meeting Richard, what were some of your surprises?
Well, you have to understand, John, that at the point that I ever was in Richard's company, he almost had no use of his body any longer.
Okay.
I went to his house on a number of occasions and sat with him and played music with him. He was a great lover of jazz, and I would take a lot of music to his house to listen to, and he was mentally present. You couldn't miss that, but he was no longer able to speak or really control his body very well. He was strapped into a wheelchair. So I would have never imagined, you know, in my wildest dreams that I would ever be sitting with Richard Pryor and I would be the one doing all the talking. That was disconcerting, I have to say. But it was a tremendous honor to just be in his company and to feel myself welcome in his company.
I want to say you and your brother David wrote a fascinating book. I highlighted a lot of the passages in the book, and I want to go through those with you, if you don't mind.
I don't mind at all.
Okay. Everyone knows that Richard grew up in Peoria, Illinois, but it was more than just him growing up in his grandmother's brothel. It was the other individuals that made up that neighborhood that gave Richard the genius that we know of today. Is that correct?
That seemed to be his take on things. That you know, Richard, you know, found that there was such a diverse, you know, so many characters surrounding him in the way that he grew up, and you know, in that particular moment in time, and in that particular city. Not to mention the fact that yes, his grandmother, who primarily raised him, ran a brothel, and that his mother was a prostitute, and his father ran a pool hall, and you know, he was exposed to a lot, and a lot of it incredibly harsh and brutal for, you know, for a young person to experience. And yet he also said that all the characters that he represented on stage were people that he saw around him when he was growing up.
One would be surprised because besides the information on Richard, there's also a lot of history where one would not have known that Peoria was one of the cities that actually predated Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott.
Correct. You know, I think, you know, both David and I were pretty dedicated when we began this book, John, to, I mean, not only telling Richard's story, but I think anybody who cares about Richard has some idea of who he became and then what became of him.
Mm-hmm.
But we were really, really intrigued about the landscape from, you know, out of which he walked. You know, what world allowed an artist like him to happen? And very fascinating to me that he came of age and grew, you know, towards being a, you know, a performer, you know, in a very particular moment where, you know, post vaudeville, you know, the last days of, you know, what was known as the Chitlin Circuit, you know, morphing into the nightclub years that saw people like Lenny Bruce, who were really changing the way in which, you know, comedians thought about their craft. I mean, I'm always saying about Richard that
mm-hmm.
I don't think of him so much as just a comedian. I certainly don't rank him with other comedians. I think of him as a great artist who used comedy as a delivery system, but what was unique about Richard was his point of view and the way that he could stand on a stage and speak to audiences, both black and white, you know, as an example, and speak brutal truth and have people love him for it and not be defensive and despise him for the truth he was revealing, because he owned it himself first and foremost. And his really beautiful and gentle, vulnerable manner allowed people, you know, when he held up our shortcomings as human beings, you know, rather than be defensive, people would say, yeah, that's exactly what we're like, and give up that laugh of recognition, which is what connects us, which is why his work, I think, was so powerful.
I know that's right. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio, and we're speaking with Joe Henry, co-author of Furious Cool, Richard Pryor and the World That Made Him. Mr. Henry, one would not expect Richard, well, I guess they would maybe as a young man, but the influence I think Mary Whitaker had on him when he came to her and wanted to participate in one of her plays.
Right. You know, she was really pivotal in his life,
right,
and that she saw very early on, not only he was a young person who, you know, who needed some focus and somewhere to go that was safe. You know, she recognized a very, you know, not only an innate, instinctive gift, but saw also that this was a young person who, you know, even if working very naively, was developing this gift. I mean, one thing that a lot of people don't know is that when Richard was in elementary school, for instance, he was so he was such a cut-up, and he disrupted the class so often doing his routines and acting out different characters that his teacher made a deal with him at one point just to try to control the situation.
Right.
Hey, if you behave yourself all week, I'll give you 5 minutes at the end of the day Friday to stand up and do a routine. And so, you know, already he had negotiated himself, you know, a regular performance gig, and saw, I think, you know, as a very young person, that was something that gave him some personal authority. I can do something that nobody else can do, and this is what I have to offer.
At some point, Richard had to leave Peoria and ended up in New York in Greenwich Village. Tell us about that experience.
Well, I think it's really fascinating, John, to look at when Richard was really starting to own his own voice, mm-hmm. as a performer and a writer and a conceptual artist, performing in the nightclubs in Greenwich Village in the early 60s. It was in the same moment and within the same few blocks, even, that Bob Dylan was doing the same thing, that Miles Davis was really coming into his own, you know, out of the shadows of Dizzy Gillespie and Roy Eldridge and the people who had come before him so significantly. So not only was Richard ready, but the times were ready for people to be reimagining the landscape and reinventing themselves as artists. I think it's really amazing to imagine walking those streets in 1963 and 64 and thinking about within a very few blocks, you know, there was Richard and Bob and Miles and Lenny Bruce and Thelonious Monk and Richie Havens and the Beat Poets and all these people who are sort of seeming to work from disparate places, but all sort of inventing something that the times, you know, had to allow. You know, it seemed like the moment just sort of cracked open, and the few people who were visionaries, like Richard, you know, were there ready to take advantage of it.
I found it interesting reading the book that you as a musician use metaphors and other connections between musicians and Richard throughout the narrative.
Well, you know, I think music sort of exemplifies the way that all great art really works.
Okay.
I mean, there's an inherent mystery to it. And in truth, you know, Richard was a great fan of music, and there's something really musical about what he does. I mean, if you watch his greatest routines, and I urge anybody who hasn't seen it in a while or are coming to Richard fairly fresh, you know, stay away from the movies of his later career. But go back to his original live in concert film from 1979 in Long Beach. There's still never been a greater moment of stand-up comedy ever filmed. It still stands above anything you can imagine. You know, one man, one microphone on the stage for an hour and 10 minutes or whatever it is, sort of giving up everything, you know, talking about everything that could possibly matter, you know, life, death, sex, race, mortality, marriage, an incredible act of unifying, you know, our human connection, I happen to think. And I bring that up in answer to your question, because I think when you really hear him at the top of his game, there's something undeniably musical about the way that he speaks and the way that he adopts a character and the way that he paces an evening. And it's immediate. And, you know, music is only real when it's in the air. You know, a record or a piece of sheet music is just the idea of what might happen. Music is only music when it's in the air, you know, around you like weather. And I think, you know, Richard's work is only alive, you know, when you conjure his voice up into the air from a record, from a film. He becomes alive again in front of you. And that's the great, you know, magic of art that you leave behind.
My kids, boy, when they lie, though, that's the thing that I love the most. When they be trying to tell them lies and you know they lying, right? You say, who broke this? Huh? I say, who broke this? Okay. I'm gonna tell you, okay? First, I wasn't in here, right? First, I was in the kitchen, okay? Uh-huh. Then when I was in the kitchen, you know what happened? You don't know what happened? Okay, I'm gonna tell you, okay? Then I was in the kitchen, okay? Then I was running in here. I wasn't really running. you remember when you told me not to run? So I wasn't really running, but it was kind of like I was running. My legs was moving real fast, looked like I was running, but I wasn't really running, And I was in here then when that thing was already broke. That was broke even before I was born. And when that door was fell back like that and it broke and it fell down and it was broken. That's what happened.
Tell us how Richard got on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Well, you know, at the point that he got on, I think he was a last minute replacement.
Right.
And I'm not sure that he felt he was ready for that moment yet. I'm sure he was terrified. And if you can have a chance to see the clip of his first appearance on there, I mean, he's beautifully funny, but you can't miss his vulnerability, which I think is, again, what made him connect with so many people, you know, as opposed to being such a, you know, a divisive character, which he might have been at that particular moment in time of the early 60s. But his vulnerability and his willingness to stand, you know, in it and advertise it, you know, I think you couldn't miss that he was a unique voice and that he was offering something and in a way that nobody else could.
Richard finally moved west, and he was eventually ended up in Berkeley and doing that Flower Child era. Tell us about that experience and brought him back to Los Angeles.
Well, I think it's fascinating to trace that quick part of that story, you know, where he had come west because, you know, he wanted to be in movies ultimately,
right.
and things were really happening out here. I'm speaking to you from Los Angeles. But, you know, there's the famous story of him having an opportunity to go play a main room at a big casino in Las Vegas,
mm-hmm.
where he's on stage and he described a number of times walking out onto that stage and standing there and ready to begin his act and looking out at a very well-heeled white audience, seeing Dean Martin out front and recognizing that, you know, they wouldn't let my grandmother in this place. And he very famously dropped the microphone, said in more colorful language than I'll say on your show, what am I doing here?
Exactly.
And walked off. And, of course, was told you'll never work in this town again, and for all practical purposes, he did not. But that's when he sort of realized that he had to reimagine what he was doing, that he couldn't be Bill Cosby Jr. And he fled to Berkeley for a while, took a performance hiatus, and was spending time with members of the Black Panthers, was studying Malcolm, listening deeply to Marvin Gaye and Miles Davis, and I think understood partly instinctively, but partly from the challenge of people like Huey Newton and Bobby Seale, that whatever he did had to be his own and it had to matter. You know, he couldn't just be pleasantly funny, making, you know, funny quips about the airlines and, you know, bad commercials on TV. That you know, the times were, you know, in heavy shift, and that he had a responsibility, you know, to get involved and to be as bold as he could be. And so when he returned to Los Angeles, you know, he was sort of, you know, quote-unquote politicized. And I don't even think of that in terms of being, you know, a political voice, you know, like the Panthers might have imagined him being, but political in owning his own story, as brutal as it was, and owning what it meant to be an African-American, you know, in America in that moment, and share it in a way that people wouldn't just shut down, but would be able to hear it.
Mr. Heming, you had alluded to, and I had skipped that part and want to bring it up now. When Richard started out, he wanted to somewhat model himself after Bill Cosby because it was just Bill Cosby and Dick Gregory who were, and then along with Red Fox, were the only black comics that were working frequently when he was getting his game together.
True enough. I mean, and of all those characters, you know, obviously Red Fox, tremendously important, especially in Los Angeles and
right.
the comedy world that developed here. Dick Gregory, we all know how important he was politically and every other way. Bill, on the other hand, though, was not only, you know, on the scene, but he was in the mainstream.
Right.
And Richard, in fact, when he first began, you know, was on the road to sort of owning his own voice and telling his own stories. But at a certain point, I think he told the story about being on tour in Toronto and seeing a picture of Bill Cosby in Time magazine and thinking, you know, this guy's doing what I'm trying to do. And, you know, according to Richard, you know, they're only going to let one of us through the door at a time. If I have any hope of getting anything real significant going, I'm going to have to do what he's doing. And for a while, he'd modeled himself after Bill's very congenial, non-threatening nightclub act that had been so successful. But I think, you know, in a very short period of time, he realized that was not his authentic voice, and he certainly couldn't tell his authentic stories and be that pleasant only. You know, Richard came from a much darker place ultimately, and needed to dig into it.
Mr. Henry, I found it revealing and revelating that Richard wrote Blazing Saddles and then were turned down as the lead actor for Cleveland Little.
Yeah, that's a surprise to a lot of people, and it's a heartbreak because you can only imagine how great he would have been in that role.
Right.
But I think, you know, Cleveland Little was a very traditionally handsome man, and he also didn't have the reputation that Richard was developing for being difficult and unreliable. And so when it really came down to it, I think Richard fully believed that Mel Brooks was going to stand up and say, this is Richard's part, or nobody does it. And he, in fact, did not. Richard was incredibly hurt when that role that he had created had gone to Cleveland Little.
Another interesting tidbit that a lot of people didn't know, and I didn't know, when Richard did the narration for the Wattstack concert, I thought it was all part of the deal beforehand, but it wasn't.
No, they thought, after the scramble to make something cohesive out of that event, and as a film, I think the filmmakers knew very shrewdly that they needed a unifying voice, and there was really nobody else on the scene in that moment who could sort of step in and be that thread that connected that, you know, whole event into something that plays like it does on a film. And I think that film holds up incredibly well if you go back to it.
How did Richard gain basically carte blanche at the Comedy Store?
Because he was, I mean, as everybody tells it, comedian Richard Lewis shared with us, with David and myself, that there was just, you know, he was so clearly light years from everybody else.
Joe Henry, co-author of Furious Cool, Richard Pryor and the World That Made Him. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at jhanson, H-A-N-S-O-N, at kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.